turn this afternoon to 1 Samuel chapter
25, 1 Samuel chapter 25, as we look at this story of King David, and especially in relation to this topic of anger management. Anger is a problem that I'm sure all of us in this room suffer from at various times in our lives. Now, the Bible teaches that there is righteous anger. God is angry at certain things. So anger in itself is not always wrong. Any anger that reflects God's anger is never wrong. But any anger that doesn't reflect the anger of God is a sin. And it's easy for us to fall into that sin. Now, in chapter 24, we looked at last time, we praised King David. We said how David restrained himself when he was provoked by Saul. How he could have lost his temper. How he could have lost his cool. And sought to take revenge on this man Saul for what Saul had done to him. But in chapter 25, the place where we praised David before, we have to note his failure, his weakness in this chapter. And of course, that reminds us, doesn't it, straight away, that the fight against the flesh is a daily battle. And the victory we have yesterday will not guarantee us the victory tomorrow or today. And just because you and I are able to overcome a particular sin on a particular moment in our lives, it doesn't guarantee that when the same type of sin comes again, the same temptation, we will react the very same way. In fact, let me put it this way. Sometimes we are at our most vulnerable to a particular sin after we've just had a particular victory over that particular sin. Why? Well, sometimes we become very complacent, don't we? You say, I dealt with that yesterday. I was able to deal with that problem. And we almost forget to ask God's help when we come to the next time we face the temptation. And you'll notice in this 1 Samuel 25, not once does David seek God's help to deal with the same temptation that he faced in the chapter before. Now, David was a man. David was a great man. But David was just a man. And he was a man with feet of clay like you and I. He was a man who could fall at the point of his strength from the day before. He was a man who could succumb to temptation like you and I. And of course, you and I need to pay particular attention to this chapter. Just as we praised David in the previous chapter, and we said to ourselves, I would like to emulate David when he faced Saul in that crisis, so we must also look at David's life and say to ourselves, I must also learn from him in his failure. Instead of emulating his example, I must avoid his example in 1 Samuel 25. Now, they were introduced in this chapter to two other characters that we haven't come across at this point in the story. We come across this man, Nabal, and his wife, Abigail. And immediately, at the beginning of the chapter, we're told that this man, Nabal, has a number of characteristics. First characteristics we learn of this man, he's a very wealthy man. He has an abundance of material things. We also discover that he comes from a very good pedigree. He's from the house of Caleb. Now, if you don't know who Caleb was, you go back and study the Old Testament, and you will discover that Caleb was one of the greatest leaders that Israel ever had. He was one of the great men of faith, great man of courage. He was one of the two spies who made it into the promised land. And when he made it into the promised land, he achieved many great things for the Lord. In fact, the Bible describes Caleb as a man who wholly followed the Lord. Wholly followed the Lord. He's consistent. He's godly. He's a great man of faith. But sad to say, his descendant, Nabal, or Nabal was no such character. In fact, the Bible tells us in verse 3 that Nabal was churlish. That's an old English word that means he was stubborn, he was cruel, he was hard-hearted, and he was evil in his doings. He's a man who didn't have an honorable character. He took advantage of others. He was a man who couldn't be trusted. His word wasn't his bond. In fact, you could put it this way. Nabal was the very opposite of what his illustrious forefather, this man, Caleb, was. Now, he's rich, but he has a bad character. He has no class. He has no dignity. He comes from a good background, but he doesn't live up to the background that he comes from. Now, the word Nabal, or Nabal, is an interesting word. The word means fool. I don't think it's a name that you'd want to call your child at the birth of the child. But maybe the parents of Nabal saw something of his character in him. And they called this boy, born into their home, fool. Fool. And like his name, so was his character. He fully lived up to that character that he was named after. And Nabal does not lack money, of course, but he certainly lacks class. He certainly lacks godly character. And often you'll find that with rich people, especially people who inherit wealth, that they lack godly character. They lack class. They lack dignity. They have a very self-centered attitude to their possessions. If you look at the verse where Nabal begins to talk about his life and his possessions, you'll discover Nabal is a man who is very self-centered. You look at verse 11, for example. When Nabal describes his life, you'll notice that he doesn't think of God in his words. Notice that. He says, "Shall I then take my bread?" Notice the pronouns he uses. My bread and my water. That's how he sees his possessions. My flesh that I have killed. All of these statements, of course, are unbiblical and untrue. None of these things that Nabal possesses, he belongs to him. The Bible makes clear the earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof. The Apostle Paul says in the book of Corinthians, "What have you got that you didn't receive from the Lord?" is what Paul says. What do you have that you didn't first receive? Nothing. Right now we're in the midst of a drought in Singapore, aren't we? As we look around us, we discover that even the water we can't control. Even the glass of water that we drink from, we need God's interference in our lives. We need God's provision in our lives. Just to provide a glass of water for you and I to drink, or to water the crops or the grass or the plants around us. And Nabal, he has forgotten in his material wealth, he has forgotten God. He reminds me of that fool in Luke's gospel, the man that the Bible describes as a rich fool, who talks about my possessions. He talks about my barns, my fruits, that I have built by my efforts. And he says to himself, "I'll pull down my barns and build greater." God said to him, "Thou fool." Thou fool. That's what God described that man. Thou fool. God warns that this man, today you will lose your life, God says. Your soul will be lost. And he says, "Whose will these possessions be? You won't have them anymore. I gave them to you. I can take them away from you. I give you life. I can take a life away from you." And Nabal is a man who has all of these possessions. He has no character. He has no class. He has no interest in God. He just looks at all of the possessions that he has accumulated. Maybe he's accumulated them because he's inherited them from Caleb. Maybe he has accumulated them because he's such an evil man that he's managed to take advantage of others. We're not told. But he looks at all of these material possessions and he says, "They're all mine. Mine. They're for my glory. I got them. And I own them. And I'm going to use them for anything I want for myself." Well, that's this man, Nabal. But then we're told there's another character in the story in verse 3. We're told of the wife of Nabal. And where Nabal is churlish, where Nabal is dishonorable, where Nabal has no class or no character, his wife is the polar opposite. Not only does she look beautiful, we're told she has a beautiful countenance, but right up front we're told she's a woman of good understanding. She's not just beautiful outwardly, she's beautiful inwardly. She has a godly character. She has a meek and gracious character, as what God loves to see in a woman. And of course, we're tempted to ask the question, how did a woman like that ever end up marrying a man like Nabal? Well, we're not told, are we? Maybe it was an arranged marriage by her parents according to the custom of the Middle East. We just really don't know. And sometimes you'll find that. You'll find good women married to very bad men. You'll find women of good character married to men of very bad character. And of course, vice versa. Vice versa. God in his providence seems to permit that in certain situations. But we come now to the incident of the shearing of the sheep. We've met the two characters in this story that we haven't met before, Nabal and his wife Abigail. And then we come along to the story of how they run into David. We're told in this story that David and his men, his 600 men, who were showing kindness to all of the people of the area of Judah, and were taking care of their needs and watching out for them, especially when groups like the Philistines would come in their raiding parties and try to take away their livestock and take away their possessions, David and his 600 men would be there almost like a protection force, a militia. And they would intervene and they would help them. They would protect them. And if their sheep wandered off from the other sheep, David's men would be there to pick them up and bring them back to Nabal's shepherds and say, "There's restoration for the sheep that you have lost." That was David's character and David's men. That's what they did. Once a year, maybe a very simple analogy would be something like Chinese New Year or Christmas. It was customary at that time for those who benefited from the good of their neighbors or good of other characters in the community, they would show their thankfulness by giving them a token. By giving them the token of their wealth. And David was aware of this custom at the time of the shearing of the sheep, verse 4 tells us. And David sends a group of his men with a message for Nabal. Now, as you read this story, notice he doesn't send a very threatening group. There's no threat involved. David's men are humble, they're courteous, they're gracious. And they describe David as "thy son, David." There's no pride here. There's no demanding here. It's just a nice, gracious request based on the work that they have provided for Nabal and his household. Now, Nabal's not poor. We saw that right up front at the beginning. He has incredible wealth for a man of that stature in that community. And David is just saying to Nabal, "We have helped you. The laborer is worthy of his hire. Now please give us a little token of grace. I have 600 men and women and children to feed. Now please show us some kindness in return." Nothing unreasonable in David's request. But as soon as Nabal hears, and of course he's called a fool, and his words reveal what a fool he really is. Because only a fool would take on a man like David, who's famous for his military exploits. Only a fool would try to annoy a man like David, who is a mighty warrior, a man who has 600 armed men under his command. Only a fool would behave like this when asked in a gracious way like David, "Can you just give us a token to pay back some of the effort, some of the labors we have done on your behalf free of charge?" Only a fool would behave this way. And you'll notice as you read Nabal's response, how Nabal uses every word he could think of to hurt David.
Let me go through it carefully and you'll pick this up. Every phrase is like a dagger into the heart of David. He says in verse 10, who is David? Who is David? David's message was, thy servant David, thy son David. Nabal just turns around and says, who's David? Such disrespect to a man who had killed the Goliath, the giant, on behalf of Nabal and the people of Israel. Such disrespect to the man who had fought against the Philistines time after time on behalf of the nation of Israel. And who was a member of the nation of Israel? Nabal. Who had benefited from David's warrior expertise? Nabal. And Nabal just turns around and says, who's David? Who's he? He's nobody. David was the son-in-law of the king. David was the head of the armies of Israel under Saul. David was the hero of Israel that even the women said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And Nabal says, who is he? What a fool. Then he goes on to say this. And who is the son of Jesse? Now, who was the one who was using language like that? Saul, wasn't it? We saw that before. He's really saying, who's the son of Jesse? Jesse's a nobody, and David's a nobody. Lowly origins. He doesn't say David's the son of Saul, the son-in-law of Saul. No. He doesn't bring that up. He says, who's the son of Jesse? Who's that nobody from Bethlehem? And then he adds this little, almost nasty aside, he says, in verse 10. There be many servants. That's how he sees David. Just a servant. He says, there be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. In other words, his implication is this. David's just a nobody who's Saul's servant, who's just a rebellious servant who wants to stir up trouble against his master Saul. He's a nobody. He's worthless. Now, was David going around attacking Saul? No. Had David been very loyal to Saul? Absolutely. We saw that even in the previous chapter. When Saul tried to murder him multiple times, David doesn't respond. David keeps being gracious to Saul. David never picked a fight with Saul ever. David did everything he could to avoid division with Saul. And yet, Nabal just turns it around and sticks the knife in. He says, there's boys like you, he's really saying, who go around rebelling against their master. Then he adds this, verse 11, we've already spoken of it. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? In other words, he says, these men aren't worth wasting my food on. They're nobodies. And every word he's saying here, he's trying to stir up David. He's trying to stick the knife deeper into the heart of David. And we're told when David heard these things, verse 13, those words that hurt David, David reacted the wrong way. Oh yes, David was right to be angry. He was right to feel the pain of the words. You know, there are people who say this little expression, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. I don't know what world they've ever lived in, because I've never come across anybody that hasn't felt the pain of insults that have been hurled against them. By the way, the Hebrew word that's used to describe Nabal's accusations against David is a Hebrew word that's very strong. It's a word that means like the shrieking of a bird of prey. It's a word that means full of hateful accusations. That's how Nabal treated David when David's men came and said, you know, could you give us a token for all the labors we've done for you? David, your servant, he just asked, at this time of the year, will you show some kindness to him? And Nabal just responds, who's David? Who's the son of Jesse? He's a nobody. Who is this man who has broken away and rebelled against his master Saul, and he wants to come to me and get some things from me? No chance.
is what Nabal is saying. And all of the commendable meekness we said of David in the previous chapter, we have to say he fails to exhibit it in this chapter. Because in the previous chapter, Saul was trying to kill David. Was Nabal trying to kill David? No. He just insulted him with a few words. And yet David reacts the complete opposite of the way he reacted to Saul in the previous chapter. Because David, you notice, his men in this chapter don't say to David, like they did in the previous chapter, "David, you take the opportunity to stick the knife into Nabal." Notice they don't say it. They don't even say a hint of it to David. Now they may have done it, we don't know, but there's no hint of it in the text. David, without seeking God's help, without seeking God's will, without even listening to any counsel from his own men or those around him, David immediately says, "Get your swords on. We're going down to deal with Nabal." David says this as he goes down to the house of Nabal. He says, "There will not be a single person left alive from the house of Nabal. Not one." Now, who was it that had insulted David? Nabal. Had Nabal's wife insulted David? No. Had Nabal's servants insulted David? No. There was only one person who had insulted David, Nabal. And yet David is so worked up in his anger, so full of anger what this man has insulted him, that he says, "I'm going to kill not just this man, I'm going to kill every single person in this house." David was serious. And his anger was so strong that it lasted all the way up until he met this woman, Abigail. It wasn't just a passing anger. It was something that consumed him. Now bear in mind, this is the same David that the previous chapter, when Saul tried to kill him, when David's own men said to David, "Stick the knife into him," David said, "No, I won't do it. It's God's anointing." And all Nabal did was insult David with a few words. And David got so mad, and the rage lasted so long in him, that David said, "I'm going to kill him, Nabal." He hadn't committed a capital offense. He just had offended David with a few words. He just insulted David. That's all. David says, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill his wife. I'm going to kill his children. I'm going to kill every servant he has. I'm going to wipe out his name from off the face of the earth." Now that's anger, isn't it? That's a complete loss of self-control. And that tells us something, doesn't it? That tells us that a Christian, if he's not careful, or she is not careful, can fall into the same sin very easily. Very easily. And just because you got the victory over that particular sin yesterday doesn't guarantee you'll react the same way today or tomorrow. Now, when one of the servants of Nabal sees what's going on and understands the character of David and the character of David's man, he wisely goes to this woman Abigail. Notice he doesn't go to Nabal. He knows there's no point in talking to a fool. But he goes to the wife. He's discerned already that this woman can be trusted. This woman has wisdom that her husband doesn't have. And he says to her, "What's going on?" And he says, "Our master," he says, "he's such a son of Belial that nobody can talk to him." And really what he's saying to Abigail is this: you've got to do something. Because if you don't do it, this man David, he's going to wipe us all off this earth. And Abigail, she's a wise woman. Because notice, she doesn't hang around. She doesn't waste time discussing. Verse 18 says she made haste. It's one of the reasons why she's a wise woman, because she not only knew the right thing to do, but she knew how to do it. And she knew when to do it. She doesn't discuss this with Nabal. She's wise enough to know that as well. It's a waste of time talking to a fool like that. Now,
Bear in mind that this woman has been married to this man for a period of time. Bear in mind that she knows he's a son of Belial. He's a fool. He's not exactly husband of the year. So she could be forgiven for thinking to herself, this may be my opportunity to get rid of him. Maybe what I'll do is I'll get on my horse and I'll head the other direction and I'll just let this man David come down and deal with this problem. But she doesn't. This woman had taken vows before God that she would be with this man for better or for worse. She does the right thing here. She immediately acts to deal with the anger of David and to try and cover up or appease the anger of David from destroying her family and her own life. She gets 200 loaves and 2 bottles of wine and 5 sheep and all of these possessions. She brings them to David. And notice her strategy reveals also her wisdom. Not only does she bring the possessions, and it's a very great gift that she brings for David. It's not an insignificant one. But when she gets toward David, she adopts the strategy of sending some of the possessions ahead of herself. Do you notice that? Verse 19. She said unto her servants, go on before me. Now, where do you think she learned that strategy from? If you go back in the book of Genesis, you remember the story of Jacob and Esau. When they were being reunited after the long period of separation, Esau had said to himself, I'm going to kill Jacob. And he brought all his 400 odd men with him, 100 from the Edomites, to hired men to come and murder David, or murder Jacob and Jacob's family. And Jacob, if you remember in the story, sent ahead certain gifts for Esau. So each time Esau came, he saw the gift, and it made him think, well, Jacob's not as bad as what I thought. Then he comes, goes a little further, he receives another gift. It's a psychological trick almost. And I'm sure that's what Abigail was thinking about when she came up with a strategy, that if she sends the material gifts first, hopefully this will start to cool down the heat of the anger of this man David. But when she meets David, she comes to David. Notice what she does in verse 23. And remember, she's not an insignificant woman. She's married to one of the wealthiest men in that region. Yet what she does is she humbles herself before David. If you read through the text very carefully, you'll see her refer to David in very respectful ways. She describes herself as David's servant, David's handmaid. She talks about David as my Lord on multiple times. She tries to win the heart of David, not only by her generosity, but by her meekness, by her submission, by her deference to him and his position. Oh, she gives us a wonderful example of how to deal not just with awkward spouses, but with awkward people, with people who are full of anger. But then she goes a little further when she sees this man David. Not only does she humble herself before him, but she reasons with him. And notice how she reasons with him. She reasons with him in a very scriptural way, a very godly way. In fact, notice her words. She appeals constantly to the name Jehovah, the Lord. Now, we saw earlier that Nabal never mentions God in his words. Nabal only thinks about my possessions, my life, my servants. Whereas Abigail, who's a much more godly person, her constant refrain is to the Lord, the Lord. The Lord has made you King David. The Lord has blessed you, David. Don't do this, David. It would be a sin against the Lord. And it would destroy your reputation, David. Your testimony, David. If you read through her language, notice how she speaks to David. Verse 24, she says, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? She doesn't distinguish herself from her husband. She knows, for better or for worse, she's one with him. But she knows that David is going to be much more attracted, not just to her physical look compared to Nabal, but to her godly character. And she says to David, "Now if you take vengeance on Nabal, you have to take it on me. Let the iniquity be on me." It's going to be harder for David to keep his anger towards Nabal when he has to direct his anger towards Abigail. She's a wise woman, how she handles this man. And then she says this. She says, "Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." She doesn't cover up Nabal's sin. She says up front to David, I know he's a fool. I know he's a bad man. It's not wrong for a wife to admit that. It's not a sin for a wife to say, in my view, that the husband has done wrong. It's not a sin to do that. She says it. She's honest about it. She's transparent. And again, I think that helps cool David down in this situation. And then she begins to reason with David in a scriptural way. She says in verse 26, "Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord Jehovah," you notice all in capitals in our KJV there, meaning it's Jehovah, the covenant God of Israel, "as Jehovah liveth, and as thy soul liveth, seeing the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood, and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies, and they that seek to do, that seek evil to my Lord, be as Nabal. And now this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought it unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid." Now notice what she said. The trespass of thine handmaid. Had she sinned? No. It was Nabal was the one who sinned by his words. But yet she keeps trying to take the attention of Nabal and getting it onto herself and saying, "He and I are one. We're a family, David. If you're going to kill him for his sin, you're going to have to kill me as well." And then she says to David, verse 28, "The Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house." She's saying this to David. Don't try to do the Lord's work for him, David. God will raise up your house, David. God will make you great, David. Ignore the fools like Nabal in this world. God is a God who will fight the battle for you, she says. "Because my Lord fighteth the battles of the Lord, and evil hath not been found in thee all thy days." She appeals to David's testimony. She says to David, "David, you have been a consistent believer. You have walked with God. You have been doing God's will." Now really what she's saying to David is this: don't block your copybook now, David. You have done so much right. Now don't add to the right by doing a wrong thing. She's pleading with him, but she's reasoning with him as well. And she's pointing him to the Lord in control. And she says, "God will raise up you a sure house, David. God will take care of you. You don't need to hurt your testimony, David, by doing a foolish thing now." Well, she's a wise woman. She's a godly woman, this woman Abigail. In verse 29, she says, "Yet a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul. But the soul of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Lord thy God." She says to David here, "You know, David, I know that Saul has been trying to kill you so many times. But David, don't you remember? He can't touch you because your life is tied up in God's life." What she's really saying to David, by way of implication here, is you don't need to fight Nabal. God will deal with Nabal. God has kept you, David. God has protected you, David. Even when Saul, your great enemy, is trying to destroy you. And David, don't you be like Saul. There's no need for you. You're God's man. God's with you. God will take care of you. And she says this, "And the souls of thine enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling." Well, I think David recognizes that metaphor, doesn't he? David was the one who God had used to fire the stone from the sling to deal with Goliath, the great enemy of Israel and the great enemy of God. And she just reminds David, just as God took care of Israel's enemy Goliath from the sling, so God will take care of your enemies in his way and in his time. No need for you, David. to take vengeance on the nobles of this world. Leave them to God. He can handle them. Don't fear this man, Nabal. Don't do a foolish thing. And then in verse 30, she shows her discernment for the future. She knows the will of God because she says this in verse 30, "And it shall come to pass, when the Lord shall have done to my Lord, according to all the good that he has spoken concerning thee, and shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel." Here's a woman in touch with God, in touch with the will of God, because it doesn't look like David's going to be king, does it? He only has 600 men. Saul is on the throne. Saul has the army of Israel behind him. Saul's son is still young and healthy, Jonathan. Saul has other sons. It doesn't look from a natural point of view that David will become king. But here's this woman, Abigail. She's in touch with God and she says, "I know you'll be the next ruler. I know God has anointed you, David. You're man, God's man. You're the man after his own heart, David." That's what she's appealing to. She's reasoning with him from God's word, God's will. And then she says to David, verse 31, "That this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offense of heart unto my Lord, either that thou hast shed blood causeless, or that my Lord hath avenged himself. But when the Lord shall have dealt well with my Lord, then remember thine handmaid." You know, this woman also has great wisdom as to human nature. She says to David this. She said, "David, if you take the life of Nabal, the life of any other people associated with Nabal," she says, "when you become the ruler, when you become the king, you're going to become the king. But when you become the king," she says, "this shall be no grief unto thee." In other words, if you don't do this, you won't have this on your conscience. But what she's also saying to David, if you do do this, you'll always carry this on your conscience, David. The blood of Nabal, Nabal's house, will be a stain on your reputation, David. Your testimony for the rest of your days. She's saying to David that your conscience will always be there, David, reminding you, you did the wrong thing. And she's really saying to David this, David, you don't want to have that on your conscience. Oh yes, you'll be king, but you'll never be a great king, because you'll have this awful stain against your name. Well, she's a wise woman. She's a discerning woman. She's a woman in touch with God. She's a woman that any man would want to be married to, this woman Abigail. She's humble. She's wise. She's discerning. She's meek. And I tell you, one of the greatest things about Abigail is that even in just a few sentences, she manages not just to calm a man like David, full of anger, full of murder, but she not only calms him, restrains him, she turns him around where he repents publicly of what he did. Notice what he says, verse 32. "David said to Abigail, Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, which sent thee this day to meet me." David says to her, "You are God's instrument. You're God's woman. I can see it." And David says, not only does he say, "You're God's instrument," he says, "Blessed be," thank God. He really says, "I thank God that God sent you, a woman like you, to talk to me before I did such a foolish thing." You know, it's very hard for any man to listen to the voice of another person when they're caught up in anger. But it's even more difficult for a warrior like David. Even more difficult for a man like David, who's been living under the tension of life and death all of these months, maybe years, with Saul trying to kill him. It's even more difficult for a man like David, who has to take care of 600 men, be responsible for them, feed them, Make sure they don't fall out and murder one another. It's very hard for a man like David, living under tension like that, to be restrained like this. And let me say this. You could multiply that when you're talking about a woman telling a man what to do. Very hard for a man like David, in David's circumstances, to listen to the voice of a woman. But this is the great thing with David. This is the great difference between David and King Saul. When King Saul was warned by Samuel, not a woman, by Samuel, who was older than him, who was God's prophet and God's priest, when King Saul was warned about his sin, Saul wouldn't listen. When Saul's son Jonathan, who was a mighty warrior and the most loyal and devoted son, pleaded with his father not to sin, not to lose his cool and take vengeance on David because of his jealousy, Saul wouldn't listen. And here's the critical difference. When David, the man after God's own heart, lost his temper and was behaving and thinking just like Saul, when he heard the voice of Abigail, he not only stopped what he was doing, but notice he publicly confessed before her and before his own men of his sin. David could have said, turned and went the other way. He could have done that. Tried to save a bit of face. But this is the great thing about this man, David. Yes, there were times that he sinned, and he sinned greatly. But I've said this before, what I like about him was, he was a great sinner, but he was a great repenter also. Great repenter. And there's a good lesson for you and I. There will be times in our lives when we give in to the flesh. There'll be times in your life and my life when you'll flare up. But make sure you react the way David does when you hear the voice of God, because this, make no mistake, this is not the voice of Abigail speaking. This is the voice of God talking through Abigail. God will often talk to you through another person. Don't expect to hear the voice of God coming from some cloud as you're walking along in your day-to-day life. God will often use other believers, maybe a spouse, maybe a family member, maybe a work colleague, just to say a word to you. Are you sure? Brother, you need to watch what you say. You need to calm down. You need to behave in a different way. You're heading for disaster if you continue along this way. And if you and I have the heart of David, we should have the heart that says, okay, let me listen. Let me pause. Let me see if this is really God's voice speaking to me about a sinful thought, a sinful action in my life. David says to her, verse 33, blessed be thy advice. David acknowledges it. This is good advice. This is good counsel. This is good wisdom I'm getting here. And blessed be thou which has kept me this day from coming to shed blood. You notice how David admits it. He doesn't say, well, thank goodness for your little bit of advice. I wasn't really going to kill Nabal, you know, just try to cover it up a bit, play a bit of a word game here. No, that's not David. David says, yeah, I was going to do it. I was going to sin. I was going to shed blood. Thank you. May God bless you, Abigail, for having the courage to condemn me, having the courage to reason with me, for having the heart of righteousness to instruct me the right way. Now remember, this is a man talking. This is a man who has killed many other men in battle. This is a man who can take a stone and take the head of Goliath. This is a man who can fight with a bear and with a lion. This is no weak man, no passive man. This is David.
This is a man who'd been general or chief of staff of all the armies of Saul. And yet when he hears the voice of God talking to him through the heart of this woman, David is broken. He's broken. David's willing to admit his weaknesses. He's not stubborn. That's the problem with Saul. He's always stubborn. No matter what God says, Saul says, I don't care, I'm going to do my will. David says in verse 35, go up in peace to thine house. See, I have hearkened to thy voice and have accepted thy person. Oh, David's very clear what he has to do, isn't he? Very clear that he's wrong. Very clear that this woman is speaking wise words to him. Wise words. David adopts a humble attitude to this word. He doesn't cover up his sin. He doesn't blame Nabal. Notice that. David just says, I've done wrong. And you're right, Abigail. And thank God for you, for intervening in my life and my circumstances, and for telling me what I should do right and what I shouldn't do, which is wrong. You know, it would be very good if not just our children but ourselves adopted the same attitude, wouldn't it be? Every time we are told the right, we should say, thank God, thank God. Instead of reacting and flying out, who are you to tell me? Who are you to speak to me? I'm sure Abigail wasn't perfect, but David had the heart after God's own heart. And the psalmist puts it this way. He said this, great peace have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. In other words, there's nothing in God's word that offends a true child of God. And when David hears the voice of the shepherd calling him through the voice of Abigail, he's not offended by it. In fact, he thanks God for it. And he cools down straight away in this situation. And often, that's our problem. We don't do that. There's the old expression, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Temper gets you into trouble. Pride keeps you there. Pride keeps you there. Temper gets you into trouble. Pride keeps you there. Temper got David into trouble here. Oh, yes. But pride didn't keep him there. When he heard the voice of God speaking through Abigail, David humbled himself and said, you're right, I'm wrong. And he did it publicly before his men. David didn't say to Abigail, come, you and I just have a little word together. Whisper in my ear. I don't want anybody to hear this. I don't want to lose any face here before all these soldiers that I, David, the great warrior, have been scolded by a woman. Oh, no. David takes it well. Takes it publicly. David humbles himself. And Proverbs says this. Listen to the words of Proverbs chapter 25, verse 12. It says, as an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. As an earring of gold, what does the earring do? It beautifies the ear. As the earring of gold in the ear, so, Proverbs tells us, is a wise reproof or wise reprover upon an obedient ear. It's a decoration. It's an adornment. It's a beautiful thing when you see a man or a woman obedient to the voice of a godly reproof. That's a beautiful thing. And Abigail's words match up to Scripture. And because her words match up to God's words, David heeds the voice of Abigail. He blesses the voice of Abigail. He thanks God for the voice of Abigail. And here's a lesson to all of us here, especially maybe to wives
in this place. The best way to win your husband is to adopt Abigail's attitude. To be meek, gracious. To reason with him, or reason with your children, or reason with other people. You reason with them from God's word. You notice how she does? She doesn't reason from any psychological, emotional trick that she uses to control this man. No. How Abigail is going to reason and counsel David is, first of all, humble herself and give to him where others wouldn't give to him. And then she takes God's word, the principles of who God is, and she starts to reason with David. She says, David, you don't want to do this. David, you don't want to destroy your testimony. David, God will deal with your enemies. You don't need to take the blood of Nabal. God will deal with Nabal's. Hasn't God taken care of you in the past, David? Hasn't he dealt with your enemies in the past, David? Do you not remember that man, Goliath? Didn't God take care of him? David, you don't need to react in the flesh. Don't need to lose control of yourself. David, if you do this, you'll have a conscience that will throb all the days of your life, warning you, condemning you for the sin that you're about to commit. For this woman has a great godly way with words. What a woman she is. What an example she is to us all, and especially to the wives here. And you know, she goes back home, this woman Abigail. She doesn't tell her husband straight away. Again, she shows the wisdom. She knows that here's a man who's drunk. No point wasting words on a man like that. But she waits until he sobers up. And then she goes to Nabal. She tells him, Nabal, you almost lost your life yesterday. Nabal, you did a very foolish thing. Nabal, you attacked God's anointed with your words, and it almost cost you your life and the lives of all of us. Nabal, you're acting like Saul in your behavior, like a little Saul. What you are. And we're told that Nabal's heart died within him, and he became as a stone. Verse 38, then it came to pass about 10 days after that, that the Lord smote Nabal, that he died. God gave this man 10 days. Do you see that? 10 days. 10 days of grace. 10 days to think of repenting from his wrong words about David. 10 days to change his attitude to God's servant. But notice the words here. It's very, very clear. After the 10 days, notice the words, the Lord smote Nabal and he died. Did David have to take vengeance into his own hands? Who took care of the Nabal? God did. I'm sure David learned a lesson, a great lesson in this. You don't have to take vengeance on your personal enemies. God will deal with them. Just wait a little longer, David. Just be patient. Just take the insult from the Nabals of this world. Because around the corner, God will deal with them. Vengeance is mine, said the Lord. But then he adds this, I will repay it. I will do it. I saw it. I saw the Nabals in your life. And I'll deal with them. You don't need to be like David. You don't need to get your sword on and go and give Nabal what his just deserts, or what you think is his just deserts. Just leave it to me. And I'll take care of it. And David learned that lesson. And I'm sure David learned that lesson for many, many years in his life, because as you read all of 2 Samuel of David's life, it's very, very rare that we see David losing his temper in this way again. It's very, very rare where David takes out the sword in anger and tries to attack another man. David learned the lesson of this chapter. God can deal with the Nabals of this world if you just leave it up to him. We're told that when David heard that Nabal was dead, David learns this lesson. This is not just my reasoning, because David says in verse 39, "Blessed be the Lord." Thank God, he says, "I didn't take vengeance, because God hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal." Now notice what David goes on to say in this verse. He could have just said, "Thank God, God dealt with Nabal. Serves him right." I think most of us would say that, wouldn't we? He got what he deserved. Reap what he sowed. Good. But David says this. He doesn't cover up that Nabal had done wrong. He says, "God has dealt with Nabal." David doesn't try to sugarcoat it. He tells the truth. But then he adds this in verse 39. "And hath kept his servant from evil." Oh, David sees, "God had mercy on me. God kept me from making a fool of myself. God kept me from behaving like Saul." And then David, we're told, sent and asked for Abigail to be his wife. And as we take that thought, notice the thought in verse 44. "But Saul had given Michal his daughter, David's wife, to Phalti, the son of Laish, which was of Galim." Saul deliberately gave the wife of David to another man. Why? Because that was like publicly saying, "He's no longer my son." It's like a divorce from the royal family. Saying, "David, you're cut off." And David recognizes in this woman Abigail. Now, he had no choice in his first wife. His first wife was given to him by Saul, if you remember, Michal. But in this second wife, David chooses a woman with the right character. Do you see that? He recognizes it's good to have a wife like that around you. It's good to have the companionship and the wisdom of having a wife like that, who's not afraid to tell you if you're wrong, but tell you the right way. That's a good wife. Good wife. What do we learn in closing about anger? We learn that anger is a problem for even the best of God's servants. We learn that anger is something that can strike us even after we've had great victories against it. We learn that anger is something that can strike us in our personal relationships. Do you see that? Personal relationships. You know, we make excuses for losing our temper all the time, don't we? We say, "I'm provoked." Or we say, "That's my nature. That's just the way I am." We say, "I just explode. I've got a short fuse." Here's the reality. Here's the truth. You can control it. You can control it. Let me just prove it to you. Many times we control our temper when we're in certain places, don't we? Maybe when we're in the workplace, we know how to control our temper there. Or maybe when we're losing our temper with someone else in our family, the phone rings and it's someone from the church and we very quickly switch temperament, don't we? We know how to control when we want to control. We know how to adopt a different tone when we want to adopt a different tone. But yet we try to tell ourselves, "Oh no, it's just my nature. I can't control it. I just explode." No. Anger is a sin. This type of anger is a sin. There's no excuse for it. Listen to what the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 31. "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." You notice he uses the word "all" there two times. All anger, all anger, all anger. No loopholes Paul gives. No excuses for it Paul gives. You can control it. You just don't want to control it. You're able to control it when it suits you. Paul says, don't let it be part of your testimony. Because the moment you keep exploding with anger like that, you're behaving like who? Saul. You're behaving like Saul. David gave us the wrong example here, didn't he? How not to control yourself. He gave us the wrong example of how to deal with those who personally insult us. But let's give him some commendation. He gives us the right example of how to deal with the consequence of your anger. He gives us the right example of how to deal with your life when you hear the voice of God speaking to you. And the very fact that a great man like this, who had such an amazing control of his temperament in the chapter previously, could fall in this chapter to this sin in such a way that he was willing to murder a man and his home and his servants in cold blood. The fact that David was willing to do that shows to all of us that it could happen just to us, just as easily. Paul the Apostle makes that wonderful statement, let him who thinketh he standeth take heed lest he also fall. Beware of your temper. Beware. It's a terrible thing. David lost it. But thank God, he got it under control. And you must also deal with this temper before you destroy your testimony also. That's anger management. God's style. Not the psychologist's style. That's anger management from the Bible. Let us pray.